Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support, and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to this week's episode. This week we are delighted to be joined by Frank, an absolute legend, a really vital and important person in the space of male fertility awareness raisers, advocates, however, insert term here. He's also a fellow twin father, so we have that very familiar thousand-yard stare. So, if Frank and I both fall asleep, Kieran, then pick it up from there. But yeah, Frank, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. It's an absolute pleasure. I've been listening and watching what you've been doing, and yeah, so grateful to be on.
All right, mate, it's our pleasure to have you. And yeah, like I said, you're so important in this space. Like everything you do, I always keep a keen eye on what you do because it's vital. And just recently, you're in the national press, which is great. And thanks for everything that you do.
No, much appreciated. I think it's I'm comfortable sharing the story, and I think that what helped me was in the community as I started to kind of research these things. I found out more from people like yourselves, questions that I asked you guys and other people. So I think if I can give a little bit back, because where I am is definitely from kind of people that I was surrounded with in the community, much like yourself. So yeah, no, all good.
Legend. So what is it that brought you into this shit show, essentially? How have you ended up here? What's your story, Frank?
So my now wife, we got married last September, but Frankie and I have been together for nearly 11 years. And classically, like you hear from most couples, sort of a few years in, we started talking about children. I've got three siblings, she's got two. So it's kind of always on the cards, both in kind of youth work roles and like surround ourselves in jobs with kind of kids, people, and you know, young adults and that sort of thing. So always quite interested in kind of having children of our own. And so, you know, we kind of made the assumption that that would be the easiest thing to do. Started to think about get the flat sorted, you know, get a bit of money saved up, make sure that we're in the line of work that would be our careers, and then maybe we can settle down and have children. And I remember, so I've been going through this again while I was kind of preparing to come on, and so I kind of relive it a bit. But my nan was suffering with kind of cancer, terminal illness, just around the time that we started to think this was the time that we would start. My wife was on the pill, and so she had to come off. So we kind of said, right, December 2020, let's go. And in the back of my head, I'm like, it's going to come around quick. And I think that, you know, she was doing a lot more research about cycles, NHS statistics on how quickly couples usually conceive. She was very aware of those sorts of things, where I'd kind of tried to take myself back away from it, all the while going on, you know, visiting my nan, and this really rough ride of sort of 6 months where stress started to build up. And, you know, we started to talk about whether or not we needed to go to get checked up and like see whether everything was okay. And around that 7-8 month mark, which is really early on, we know now, but we kind of had some friends that have been trying and been told that you need to be trying for around 18 months to 2 years before you should go to a GP. So we cheekily said, you know, we've been trying for a year and a half, and they sent us along to have our tests. She got tested, I got tested. I went into it stupidly confident. Like looking back now, I was kind of like, we'll just rule it out. I'll go in there, I'll do my thing, and then I need to focus on how I'm going to support my wife, because it's probably nothing to do with me. And then unfortunately my results came back and I had low sperm, low motility. And that, yeah, was a bit of a shell shock, first of all, because I had no idea what motility was. And my brother, my dad had kids, so, you know, why was I in this family with low levels of sperm? I hadn't been drinking for a year and a bit. I hadn't been smoking. So I kind of felt like everything should be all right, maybe a little bit overweight. But yeah, we kind of had our appointments, and I got a phone call and talked through with the doctor, who, you know, whether they were a doctor or not, but kind of just said, you've got low level sperm, low level motility. We would expect, and threw a couple of numbers out, these millions, this, millions, that. And my number was 1.5. And so that meant I was in the infertile range. And basically, you know, there's likely something wrong that's causing that, but we're probably not going to find out what that is. And the recommendation would be that, you know, if you and your partner want to conceive, although you can carry on trying, it's highly unlikely that you're not going to conceive naturally. And we would strongly recommend you going for an appointment to kind of book in an IVF appointment. So, yeah, world turned upside down, and just then trying to figure out what, why, how. A bit of a shock.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, December 20, we were in and out of lockdowns around then as well, weren't we? So,
and this was the other thing, yeah, is this was around the time of, you know, when the conversation started then around what you're going to do, we were aware that kind of IVF appointments with the NHS were not going to be on a priority list. And so this was kind of playing into our, well, what do we do? What situation will we find ourselves in? And obviously then you start to relive like people that we knew that had been through NHS and had a round of IVF and they had missed one of the important appointments and had to kind of go back and restart it all again and have another cycle. And so we had that kind of horror story that we were thinking, if we go down NHS, are we going to have a cancelled appointment? And fortunately, like, we had friends and family that sort of said that they would be able to financially support us. And so we were able to choose a private, which we did, so just on that factor that, yeah, COVID times and everything else, like, we were just so uncertain and wanted it kind of, these will be when the appointments are, these will be when the dates are, and we could get our head around it that way.
Yeah. It was a very strange time. Like, we were pregnant at that time, and what always, like, surprised me was that the NHS was, like, understandably, like, up against it. But then if I paid, I could have the same thing.
Yeah.
In the same place.
Yeah, really. I mean, it is one of those that you kind of, you don't know any information. And so, you know, we'll come to kind of now, but, you know, 3 years on, having then surrounded myself in the community, spoken to a lot of people and done my own research, like, I have an understanding. But at that point, I remember the first phone call I had from a doctor was, I had the first phone call after I'd received my results. So I had 1 week between getting an email of my results and then speaking to somebody who could talk about it. So me and the wife were sitting at Nando's having a little treat, cinema afterwards and whatnot, and having this nice time. And she said, have you looked at your results? And I said, no. And I work in the mental health sector. So I work for a small charity that supports people to find employment or sustain employment. So I'm aware of, like, our clients having kind of self-diagnosis and, you know, struggling with that. So actually, you know, we'd always strongly recommend you speak to your GP or you speak to a talking therapy clinician. And so for me, I had the results, but I didn't want to look at them because I'm not a doctor and I can't tell what they mean. But she had done a bit of research and, you know, read that that was bad, read what the healthy range was of things. And so one, completely ruined the meal, but two, just made me feel, you know, just horrible and like I had no support. So I was waiting for that call for a doctor to get a bit of a pastoral support and get an idea of, you know, what we could do. And ultimately there, it was basically the same as what she had done and just kind of read, you know, oh, I'm reading your results and this is particularly low. And it's interesting because I think that, you know, even in the first semen analysis that I went to, there was nothing on the walls. There was no information. There was no leaflets. There was no eye contact with the person that was taking my sample, let alone a conversation about, you know, how I was feeling. You should listen to this, you know. There wasn't a male infertility podcast at that point, but there were other podcasts. There were other things that were happening and there was just nothing. So you kind of have this call with the doctor and then I was left completely on my own and it didn't change all the way through. Even, you know, I went to the clinic and they were obviously interested in us going along and having IVF or ICSI with them. So they weren't interested in giving me more information. They just wanted to give, this is the specifics. This is what you'll need to do next in order to have children, which is obviously your dream, which is why you're here. And, you know, we're not going to do anything else other than tell you, yes, we'll be able to support you to have a child.
Wow. That's crazy, because what you're saying there about kind of how you felt out on a limb and isolated, that is like 4 or 5 years ago. It's the same as I felt 3 years before that and Kieran before that, but also fast forward to now or today, and it's still happening. And like the guys we've had on this, but we've had guys on this series of the pod that are still in it. They are literally still, they don't know what the end is. There's no end in sight at the moment. And as we all know how that feels, and they're experiencing the same things now. So it's really quite worrying.
Yeah, there's a massive gap in the diagnosis and the reason for it. Like, you can have a diagnosis, but you got to know the part of you really wants to know why.
Yeah,
why is that like that? And sometimes there's not an answer. Like, we really dug around for my answer, and there was no answer. They just don't know why. But at least they did the test to find out. But so many men are just left in limbo, like you've just said, Frank. And I think it's one of those situations that when a man is feeling so vulnerable, that's when the action should occur. I think, one, because the man's keen to address it and will attend those appointments. But also, it kind of helps with the guy's mental health at the same time, because of his stress about the fertility, and I'm going to say it, journey. But also, you're thinking, what the fuck's going on inside my body? What's wrong? What's wrong with me? Because no one else that I'm talking to seems to have the same condition or situation. Even though when you do actually start opening up, you find that there are people out there in a similar position. But when you're that first diagnosis, and that especially those first month or two, extremely stressful, and you're just looking for answers. Not necessarily answers about how am I going to get a baby. It's, for me personally, it was, well, what's going wrong? What's going wrong inside me? I became quite... I wouldn't say obsessed, but concerned and aware of it. Is that like this? It's that kind of, well, I want to know what's wrong for me to give me that low sperm sample. And exactly what you've just said, Frank. And so many guys are left in that limbo, and it's just not right. That gap needs to be closed or taken out completely. You know, especially when you look at the additional health conditions or risks, what research shows about having, fertility issues as a man, you are a slightly higher risk at other things, and you want to know about it, you know, because that information's missing.
Yeah, 100%. I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's how I process things. Like, ultimately, what's the cause? What's the effect? And like, it would be easier to process, easier to deal with if you're aware of why. Like, it's a really difficult thing to go and talk to your mates about, let alone if you don't know why, because that's the first thing that they ask. When I broke the news to my dad, when I broke the news to my brother, when I broke the news to my mates, they ask why, and you don't have an answer for that. And they ask what's the next steps, and you're like, IVF, basically, because I'm not going to fix this. And then it's also that piece on, you know, IVF, we wanted a child, and we knew that we wanted to go through that, but it also meant that there's just no, is there a second? Is there a third? Like, you've got to plot out the rest of your life. And I think it's definitely something that I was feeling guilty. I was feeling shame. I was feeling like demasculated, and I couldn't work out why. And generally, again, working in the mental health sector, if someone has a condition, you can work out what kind of flares that condition up, or if somebody's just experiencing poor mental health at that time, you can work out whether it's their employment, the family, the financial situation, and you can help to resolve it. And I think when you're looking to the people that NHS doctors, if I break my arm, they're going to put me in a cast and they're going to tell me, you've got 4 to 6 weeks for that to heal, come back, we'll take it off. But these doctors were saying, you're not going to be able to conceive naturally, you know, we'll book you in for an appointment. And I came in and I started to, like, the way that I processed it, I did a Comedy for Thought course, which was through the Recovery College in Ealing, attached to Brentford Community Sports Trust. And so at the time, we had a successful round of Ixery. We transferred one embryo, that split. So I had really lucky, and that I had my boys. So then, you know, we found out we were having twins, and then they were born premature. So I had all of this that we moved quickly. So my first appointment, semen analysis, was October, November time. And then December got the results, or December, you know, started to make these plans. And then it was almost like a few months later that we were sitting down, and my wife and I, like, we're getting ready to go through the whole IVF process, ICSI process. And so at the time, like, after I went to this recovery course, it all happened. And straight away, it was like, I'm struggling still with this. I don't know why. So all of my jokes were around my fertility or my infertility, and, you know, the semen analysis and everything else. And it was then that I met Kev through doing that, or from the man cave. And that's how then came to meeting all of you. And I think I started to ask questions that I'd asked doctors previously and they couldn't really answer. And you were able to give information about, you know, if it could be a varicocele, was something that I figured out for myself, listening to one of you two chatting on one show or another. And so then I asked Testim about the varicocele, because I'd got my result back after doing an ultrasound. And they said that it's an abnormal varicocele, but then decided that they weren't going to do an operation, because through an operation, non-invasive or invasive, they wouldn't have been able to guarantee that I would have any sperm, or, you know, my semen would improve. But then at the same time, they also told me that they should be testing for an ultrasound, because there is a link with infertility and cancer. So all these things that kind of should, it feels like, should be the next step, is missing. And again, you just hear more, and I'm kind of 3 years in now. My boys are 2.5, and ultimately, well, yeah, I mean, we can get to the end shortly, but I think it just is, if at the time someone there said, try this, or have a read of this, or have a look at this and come back, and do you have any support, how do you feel about talking to people, would just make things so much easier. It might not resolve anything, but certainly would have, you know, made a huge impact on me being able to have a conversation with someone and saying, how are you feeling about this? But where I went for a semen analysis was also the urology department. So fast forward a couple of years, when I've got a bit more confidence, and I went in for another test to see whether anything had changed. And I said, you don't have any pamphlets up on the wall, or you don't have any leaflets or information, or you're not playing any podcasts or anything, you know, on the stereo. Could anything change? And she said, well, we do, the majority of our tests are around cancer and testing patients for cancer. So, you know, there's a real missing link. There's something really missing.
It's that comes back. It reminds me of when I've talked about, firstly, when I had mumps, which is widely kind of believed to be the cause of my infertility. And when I was going to the doctors with, like, very inflamed, swollen balls, but not once was it like said to me, oh, this can be a cause of infertility. And this was pre-Google, pre-smartphones and all that. And then also when I found, 6 years after that, when I found a varicocele, when I was doing, like, those checks in the shower, and I went to the doctors, had a scan, and again, there was no, like, it was dismissed as, oh, it's a cluster of tubes. But there was no, like, oh, but okay, this person might not have known that that can cause infertility, or, you know, a lot of sperm damage, DNA frag, et cetera, et cetera. But it's like what you were saying there. Okay, in the urology department, they're mostly checking for cancer and stuff, testing for cancer. But it's not a wide link. We're not going in with, to come back to something, an example you gave, we're not going in with a broken arm.
Yeah.
And then expecting them to find the link between a broken arm and infertility. Yeah. It's the same area. At least have a little bit of knowledge or signposting to say, by the way, like, this could be that, or you might want to look into that a little bit more. And I fully appreciate there are complexities with that, because it could send people into unnecessary panic or Google wormholes, etc. But it's not a big leap. Like, it shouldn't be that hard. But yeah, it's, you said something that I want to bring up, actually, because you will be ending this series. You'll be the, you are the finale for this amazing series where it's been all guys talking about their stories. And you said something that I don't think has come up so far. And it's that unknown nature of, okay, you're trying for a child now, and you're desperately through like fertility treatment, but it's that, it's the long term. Like, oh, you can never map out having a second or third or however many more, because it's that, it's been robbed. And that's something that even now, our kids have just turned four. It came up recently for us.
Yeah.
Is that, and it doesn't go away, unfortunately. That choice has been forever taken from us. And we had a very brief conversation about it. It was almost open and closed within minutes of like, would we do it again? And then it's thinking of like, oh, all the injections, like all of that. And then the unknown, the uncertainty of going in, having a transfer and it not working, or like, and then all the emotional turmoil that comes with that. And not to mention like the female's hormones all over the place. So yeah, it was a very short conversation, and it's just so unfair.
It's mad, because I think with us, we actually like to go to kind of how we were feeling with the IVF piece, that was because of all the unknown and because of reading the statistics and everything. We actually found that as soon as a doctor at the private clinic said, turn up here, do these tests, and then turn up here and we can start your cycle, that became really less stressful than what we found ourselves in with the unknown. As much as we didn't know there would be that positive outcome, we then felt it's out of our hands. And actually my semen analysis improved at the time of going into that, because I think I was not feeling the same stress. But when we were successful and had our boys Theo and Ezra, when I was still asking the NHS questions, they had a blank look on their face as to why I was still asking questions, because I had been lucky. Like, I had the success that people would want. And I get that to a point, but at the same time, I still didn't know the reason why. And because of COVID and lots of appointments, I basically like went to an NHS appointment in that December to discuss IVF. And then we booked another one in for like the April, and that never happened. It kept on getting pushed back. And so finally I kept on getting these appointments that kept on getting cancelled, and it went in, and it was like 18 months after that initial meeting that they called me back in for a checkup, which I went to because I still wanted to know. And they were like, okay, Mr. Fallon, it's been a while. Has anything happened? And I was like, well, yeah, we've had a successful round of ICSI and I've got two boys. They're 18 months now. Big laugh and everything. Because ultimately, you know, I was happy. But I left that meeting and I was like, that's not something that should be laughed about. Like, this was me waiting. This was me potentially, you know, I might not have had a good relationship with my boys, knowing the troubles that I'd gone through to have them, and, you know, feeling less of a father were things that I dealt with. And luckily I found the community and was able to talk about it and was able to get some support. So I just think that actually the impact that it can have, it goes back to that piece again. But for me and my partner, you know, we put embryos on in the freezer because we had six embryos or whatever, and we're like, okay, yeah, we might come back to it. I mean, I am absolutely knackered at the moment, and I don't think I could foresee us having anytime soon. The boys are 2.5, but it is that wanting to know, and it is that, you know, needing to know whether it's a yes or a definite rule out. And I think it's the hope that really is so difficult, because every semen analysis I went into, I was hopeful that it would change. And it stuck with me. Every meal that I'm having, every time I go on a long run, I'm thinking about the impact on my balls. Like, a hot bath, I know, is really bad. That third coffee, really bad. Like, I live with it day by day, even though I've been successful.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really powerful. Yeah. And I think actually I should probably say that, you know, when my wife and I are having that discussion, and it's a short one, we speak from the privilege of having had a successful round, and obviously having had twins as well. Whereas there are many people, like Kieran's been through it like a few times and then had two separate children from it. I know I've got friends now from the community who have had to stop because they've kept going through it and had to stop for their mental health to say, we can't do this. So yeah, I do fully acknowledge that those conversations are hard. And for some people, it's not as simple as just going, no, okay, fine. Let's stop it. Let's leave it there, because you do have that, like you said, that hope, and that's what keeps it. You're going back, really, isn't it? I guess, Kieran, you might be able to give more insight on that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the discussion with Jen. Like, we, the cycles that led up to Sebi being born, I mean, I've spoken about it on this, but they put me in a place that I never thought I'd go. And I felt like I wasn't finished with having two. I wanted another child. But there was this big part of me that didn't want to go through it because I didn't want to have to face it again. You know? And it took a lot of processing, took a lot of time. I mean, Seb was four and a bit when Enya was born. So we did, you touched on something, Frank. Like, I was comfortable with the process. I knew what was coming. But it was the emotional journey linked to it. I didn't know if I was ready for it or if I wanted to do it again. I didn't know, and this was the honest truth, I didn't know if I'd survive it again if it all went wrong. And then there's the additional side of it, of the guilt linked to that, thinking, well, why do I need another one? I've got this precious baby boy. Am I being selfish by wanting another one? You know, it was just emotion on emotion. But we took our time. We took our time to make that decision. We put support networks in place to make sure that I didn't get in that same position again. Because I was still having panic attacks at the time. And it was still affecting me. You know? But it's something that is subjective to each individual. You know, some people find that they are able to manage it. Some people, after the stress of that first journey, say, no, that's enough. And that is completely understandable. And something that I think, if we paid for Enya's treatment completely privately, and we did a package where we got two rounds, and if we weren't successful, we got 75% back. And we had made the decision that if that didn't work, we'd call it. We wouldn't keep doing it. But it takes a lot. And now we're in a position, we've had a serious conversation lately, because we have embryos on ice just sat there. And it's like, what do we do? Like, I would love another child, but at the same time, can I give them everything they need? And can I be the father that I need to be for that child? There's like, we're starting to think about it more now. And then there's that massive part of me that thinks, I don't know if I can let an embryo just go, because it could be another little one that we've worked so hard for. You know, it is an absolute minefield. And I don't know what the decision will ultimately be, but that second going for Enya was incredibly difficult, because I knew I was going to have to face my infertility again. This situation is slightly different, where the embryo's there. If it did work, it worked. If it didn't, it didn't. And I know that sounds really cutthroat kind of almost a comment, but I haven't got to face my infertility again, if that makes sense. It's there, it's ready to go. But Enya was hard. It was really hard, that second child. You know, I respect anyone that goes for a second attempt, because it is really tough. It's something that's not talked about much. Everyone focuses on the first one, but each time you go, you've got to drag it all up again. Especially if you're going for a fresh cycle, and there's the financial aspects and everything else. Like, we've been through it all.
Yeah. No, it's, It's so tough. And if I'm honest, like, I admire you guys, because I was doing a lot. I was going on podcasts. I was speaking. I was kind of doing press releases when I could and speaking about our story. And my wife kind of talked about how she struggled reliving that. And she came on a podcast once with me, but you know, it was like a real struggle for her. And she just wanted to focus on our story now, not kind of continually relive that part of it. So I kind of took a step back because, you know, I was really proud of our journey, but obviously it's a two-person thing. So I was, you know, understanding of her. But also I found it really tough because, like, we had been successful and I was having conversations with people that hadn't, and that's difficult. And I was looking for my results to improve, and I had to kind of relive that one day I really hoped they would improve. But at the same time, I don't know, I felt like a bit of a fraud, if I'm honest, because going through that thing, and actually while we've gone through that struggle, but we've gone through IVF and we've had embryos, and then all of a sudden, like, each time I had a semen analysis, my results had improved ever so slightly. And I started to feel like I needed to step away and not think about it on a day to day, like, I focus on my work and everything else. And actually, like, through that processing it, because, like I said, every time I ate something, I would think whether this was a good meal for my sperm. Every time I had a hot bath, like I was saying, and I mentioned to my wife that, you know, these doctor's appointments that were happening and them saying they're not going to do any further investigations, they're not going to do any operations, you know, this, we're coming to the end. Like, I feel like now we can just focus on those six embryos. And she said that she had been looking in this Facebook group and had seen these kind of supplements that people were talking about called Imperil. And I started to ask questions about that. Ask yourself, Sean, and you put me in touch with someone, as classically, like, any situation happens. And I was looking at this, you know, this whole thing, putting a close on this kind of fertility journey and just being able to focus on, this is my fertility, this is what I've got to live with. One last hurrah, as it were. And in the background, my wife and I were getting married. I was eating a bag of wine gums every night, which is probably no good for arteries as well as fertility. One night happened to flip the pack around and realized it was like 83% sugar. And I had always tried losing weight, but at that point, I actually had this vision of, like, having a heart attack and dying early and not being able to watch my boys grow up, who I had really struggled to be able to have. And so at that point, I kind of thought, right, I'm getting married in September. I'm going to stop with the coffee. I'm going to lose a bit of weight, and I'm going to take this supplement to see whether there's any improvement. I also started smashing grapefruit rather than wine gums every night, so that I had something. And I've heard citrus fruit is actually quite good, with vitamin C and everything for your sperm health. And I did it for 3 months, and I messaged the person who provided me with the supplements and said, I had a semen analysis. The results were exactly the same as they were previously. I really appreciate you kind of giving me that last bit of hope, but actually I've made the point, I've made the decision now that that's it. Like, my wife and I are just going to settle with the way that things are. And they said, give it 6 more months and let me know at the end of those 6 months. Keep doing what you're doing with your diet. Feel like with the things that you've mentioned, like, certain changes might be able to happen. And I thought, all right, I'll see, you know, do it for 6 months. And went along with it, took them daily. And I went back, I went back to the clinic that we had our children through, and I did a semen analysis. And the last time that I went for a semen analysis, it was 5 million. The first time that I did it, 1.5, second time was 3. So the third time, third and fourth were both 5 million. And I went back and my sperm had increased to 20 million, which put me in a healthy range, essentially. That was kind of the figure and the number that I'd been looking at the beginning. And so I cried my eyes out when I got the results, like, phoned up the wife. I couldn't believe it. And after a couple of days, obviously being really happy and sharing it with some of the people that I was close to, mainly just the wife and my mum, I started to feel really kind of angry and like frustrated, because that, and again, it's that piece on like, you should feel really happy, but that conversation that I had with that person, the advice that they said was, there's nothing that you can do. This sort of range semen, this low semen, low sperm, low motility, that's not something to do with you and anything that you can change. That this is probably something genetic or otherwise. And my wife was there, like my wife had asked, like, is there any, you sure, like dietary changes or anything? And they said no. And so I went through then thinking that this was not something diet factor. Like I wasn't smoking, I wasn't drinking, I wasn't that much overweight. I lost a couple of stone. Maybe the daily habit of wine gums, I don't know. But like, in all seriousness though, it wasn't a conversation of come back in 6 months. And I was also frustrated at the time with the varicocele, because the whole from start to finish with my clinic was 4 months. And that can be an operation and recovery from a varicocele is 4 months as well. So each of these times, I think I liken it to that time that I went through without knowing, without being sure. And so for me, with the stress that we were under, would I have been able to lose a significant amount of weight? Would I have been able to give up the running where I was able to de-stress? Like, these are all things that maybe I wouldn't have been able to do that on the back of a conversation. But given time, I'm sure that I could have made some lifestyle changes. There was obviously that Channel 4 kind of documentary that followed people. And even at that time, I watched that show and I was like, lucky them, because I just didn't think, and I'd never been told by any medically trained paid staff, that it would be a lifestyle change that could make these adjustments. So obviously, like, the most amazing news, it means that maybe my wife and I can try and conceive. But yeah, then you think back to, and I would never change my journey, because Theo and Ezra are the most precious thing in my life. Like, if I changed the journey, then, you know, that would have all been different. But it's frustrating that some of these things aren't pointed out earlier. Like, you know, it's a full cycle from the earlier bit of the conversation. So I'm so happy, but there's a lot of frustration in there, and still the same guilt, because could I have made these changes in the 6 months before we went to the GP? Who knows?
Yeah. And ultimately, yeah, what you said is what I would echo, is there's a lot of bits that, like I mentioned too, that were potential forks in the road that weren't even signposted to me, and I've carried on blindly. But ultimately, I wouldn't change anything, because I ended up where I was meant to be. And also, I think it would be remiss of us not to say, but obviously you've mentioned Imperial, and that's like one of our sponsors, and hence why I was able to make the connection for you. But we don't just choose anyone to work with. Like, they're great people, and they're a great company, and they care, and that's why we partner with them on the pods. But like, you know, you are a first-hand example of that, having that caring side, and people who like are passionate about making a change. So yeah, that's
what, I shied away from it, Sean, as I mentioned the name, and then I thought, oh, I don't know whether I should mention that again. But again, the text conversation that I had with, am I allowed to say her name? But the text conversation that I had with her, with Fran, she sort of said, look, you know, it is those dietary and lifestyle changes that you've done, continue doing that, you know, take this alongside it. And I think that some of the things kind of just promote, this will make the difference. And I couldn't pinpoint exactly the lifestyle change, the factor, but an amalgamation of all of them, plus the process that I've been through in terms of, you know, no stress, all of that led to this. But I think it was, it was where I was, you know, that it was an opportunity, I guess. It was the kind of, and as I say, that kind of last thing that I could try. And it helped. I think the kind of taking it daily, and at the beginning of the day, I was having a conversation about how I wanted that day to look. And it wasn't just about the weight loss. It was also about, like, how am I going to show up for my kids? And am I going to be able to run around after them and that sort of thing? But this, I think, is the whole point of why your podcasts are so beneficial, and the conversations that we're having, because so much it's just so difficult to put out, like, that's going on in my head, like rattling around in my head constantly. And I think that's the, you know, it's such a highly stressful situation. I've been really lucky that I surrounded myself with you guys and other people, but also that my wife was so able to let, like, this was never any pressure from her to go through our whole journey as well. That, yeah, I kind of had confidence in continually asking questions and continually looking for answers.
I would say, in terms of the lifestyle changes stuff that you've mentioned, we live in a world where if we want something, we can get it, like, literally we're just on my phone. If I want something, it comes tomorrow. But our bodies don't work like that. If you want change, it takes time. Yes, you can take the first step today and start on that journey to make those changes, but you have to give it time. Like, as you said, that you've done it for a period of time, hadn't seen the changes that you want or you were expecting, but through the advice, you stayed at it and you saw the changes. But in the long run, I think quite often people, especially with the fertility stuff, depending where you are and your age and things like that, you don't always have time. So it becomes a lot more useful. But that's something I would really advocate to guys out there. If you're going to make lifestyle changes to try and see improvements in your fertility health, or even your health in general, to optimize your fertility, you have to give it time. Just the 3 months that they say that it takes to produce sperm isn't always necessarily the time it takes. I've had more conversations with men that have taken, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 months to see those changes. And at the end of it, they feel better anyway, because they've stuck with it longer, they've lost weight, they feel good in themselves, their mental health is good, and their fertility has improved. And it's important to say it doesn't always happen for everyone, but I look at making those lifestyle changes as two sides to it. You've got one side that you'd make all those changes and, you know, you're able to optimize your fertility health. Or you make the changes and the changes that you want in terms of your fertility don't come, but you are more mentally healthy, which will then help deal with whatever happens after that. So there's no lose situation in it, but it does take time. It just, you can't just snap your fingers and expect your biological body to change. It doesn't happen. Time, but not everyone has time. So it's an additional stress, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I think I'm as well, like, Kieran, every time I go for a run now, at some point I asked you how long you usually go for a run for, and you'd say around the 20-minute mark.
Yeah.
And that now is always in my head. If ever I'm going for a longer run, I think, oh, Kieran would have only done 20 minutes here.
If I'm going to go for a 20-minute run, I go for a good hard 20-minute run. A lot of the research shows, especially with exercise, it's the duration that you're doing things rather than the intensity. You won't be able to run at your maximum intensity for 20 minutes, but you could run at a decent speed, which at the moment the research shows that won't necessarily impact your fertility. What will impact it is if then you try to do it for an hour and a half, for 2 hours, but you do that 4 times a week, you know, it adds up. So it's definitely a time thing over intensity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep it short, keep it intense.
Yeah.
2, 3 times a week, you're fine.
Yeah. No, because at the time I was running marathons, and that's something that I've changed. Mm. And yeah, so the distances I've massively reduced. But I think there is one of those, again, you know, we mentioned it, it's that signposting piece. Like, in my line of work, somebody comes with an employment challenge, but also is experiencing housing issues, we signpost them to a housing organisation. I think there's lots of people in different fields throughout this that it's not just on the NHS staff, but they should at least be signposting them to places where they can ask these questions, where they can have these conversations. Because again, it's, you know, over the last couple of years that has really got me to a place of knowledge And yeah, it's dark days, but ultimately there is potentially light at the end of the tunnel. So
that's something I want to ask you about, actually. So you've mentioned a few times, like, you know, the stress of trying to conceive and infertility, and also what you do, your line of work, working in for a mental health charity. So probably it is a big no-no, actually. But I'm going to ask you a compound question now, like a few questions in one. But I think it's handy for you to know what I'm thinking and what, like, where to go, if where I'm going with the question, if you know what I mean. But so when it comes down to what you do for work and knowing what you know that you tell other people and have been for a while, were there things coming up for you that you started to recognize in yourself? And what did you do about it? Did you do what you tell other people to do, which you know is good advice, or did you go another way? And also, how did that work? And what would your advice be for other men in this situation?
Oh, amazing question to make me think like that. So much like I think you mentioned earlier on about, you know, we mentioned before we came on this about not really trying to give advice as such. It's more about asking questions. And I think for me, like, I'm understanding that each person that we work with will have a different approach, and it's got to be finding out, you know, what they like, what they don't like. And I think for me, I'm quite comfortable talking about it. And by talking about it, that helps me to kind of process the situation. So I said at the beginning that my nan was terminally ill. So I was suffering with bereavement and then also this low fertility. So I actually had counselling, and then I got a coach. And that co-active coach was kind of like a therapist that enabled me to have conversations about absolutely everything, because Frankie, my wife, was obviously going through this situation with me, and it could be quite intense and stressful. We had lots of conversations, but there were also times when I needed to have a conversation with somebody who I wasn't going to speak to again for a while. That became my coach. And I think I wanted opportunities to be able to speak about it. I wanted to research. I'm not a big one for reading up. So again, making my way into the kind of fertility community enabled me to build relationships, have conversations. Again, I was able to kind of share my own story, and part of that was being able to process it. I know some people don't feel comfortable, you know, talking and sharing about their personal experience, and it's a really difficult one to have to kind of live and then retell. But for me, coming on here, we're having a conversation that allows me to get a little bit more out on the page, and for you to give a little bit of advice, or, you know, something maybe I haven't thought about before. So it's not all selfless. Like, this is definitely something that's enabled me to chat about it. And I think, I mean, one last thing, because you brought work into it, like, again, I'm so understanding that my journey has been completely different from so many other men. And actually my work, working for a mental health charity that supports people with mental health conditions, I was able to speak to my boss and say, my wife and I are having fertility issues. I might be going down the road of IVF. And he, what do you need? You know, that was it. How long do you need to take out for appointments? How many appointments? Is there anything else we can do? You know, remember the employee assistance program. And that is sadly thousands of men's experience. And that is just horrible to think that you are dealing with this, maybe having challenges in the relationship and then going into work and not having a safe space there either. So yeah, I'm quite fortunate, but I've put myself out there a bit, and by doing that, I've been able to process it a fair bit.
Yeah, mate, that's an amazing answer. Thank you. And yeah, like what you said, it's that line manager lottery. I fortunately was on the good side of that and had a really supportive line manager. Didn't even know what the policy was. He just looked after me as a good man.
Yeah.
And then I changed units during our treatment, and the next person was on the flip side of that. But it changes everything. And also just want to touch upon something you said. Is you're saying, you know, it's not entirely selfless, but the first part of being selfless is being selfish, because you can't serve others and help others by being like running on a flat battery.
And yeah,
if your cup is full, you can you can pour from that full cup. And so that's what I speak to people about all the time, because I trained as a coach, so I could help guys in that situation. And you're saying that.
I think that's the...
Sorry, go on.
No, sorry, Sean, let you finish.
But yeah, it's just like we're trying to be everything to everyone, but we need to, it starts like with ourselves, and then you can really then be what you want to be for other people, is once you're fully squared away yourself, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah, that can't pour from an empty cup is my favorite. Sorry, I'm really struggling with my throat. One of my favorite sayings at work.
Mm.
But I think that the other part of that is, for men that are going through this now, I wouldn't give advice, but it would just be about how do they find, you know, support helpful? Is it reading up? And therefore, have a look here. Is it listening? Therefore, listen here. Is it speaking to people? Have a chat. That's the advice.
Oh, yeah. The like you're saying about the people you work with and know two people are the same. It's the same in anything, any walk of life, but take, obviously, infertility, like we're talking now, male infertility. I have azoospermia. I could talk to the next person who's got it, and there is we are not going to be the same. No, we could have the same root cause. We could have gone to the same clinic. We could be the same age and all that, but there's still going to be so much subjectivity there, and it's no one size fits all. What works for me might not work for the next. What we do and what Kieran and I share is we're giving people tools for their toolbox, and some might be no good for one person. Like, okay, figure it out, look at it. If it doesn't work, okay, discard it. It's about having these tools available that might work for you, and knowing that you can put them away, and as and when you need them, get them out again, to run with that analogy. But it's, and quite simply, you say about advice, is the best thing to do is listen, because people will tell you what they need if you've given them that space to share and air their thoughts when they are in a place to do so. Because again, too much is harped on about just talk. And because often that is a key phase for many people, but it's getting there, takes a while. And that seems like the obvious first step, but it's not. It's the first outward step, but a lot of internal stuff has to happen before then.
This has been an amazing chat, mate. Like, really has. When Sean said you were going to come on, I was like, oh, this would be great. So many men will gain from this, and they really have. I mean, we've talked about things that we haven't talked about with other guests, and that's the unique thing about individual stories. You know, it is an individual thing, and I can't thank you enough for just opening up and kind of putting it out there. You know, before we came on, you highlighted how sometimes it's a bit tough. It is a bit tough to face this. And, you know, me and Sean are both in that same boat. We understand this. There's been times when we've covered things on this podcast, and we've both needed time to process what we've discussed about, because it's tough. You know, so I just want to say thank you for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely.
We usually end with the question of, if you could give one piece of advice to a guy that's going through this, what piece of advice would you give him? But I feel like you've already done that, in terms of you've just done that with what Sean asked. But I'm going to ask you another question, if that's all right. And that is, what change would you like to see in the industry? If you could make one change, what do you want to see happen?
I mean, really basic, but I do think that start a point, there should be information where people go for semen analysis. And there's so much good content that you two are doing. There's so many great conversations. I think that if they had in hospitals, you know, the opportunity to listen to these, you would get so much from having a leaflet. And I can't see past that, because I know it's that connection.
Yeah.
For me, meeting people like yourselves and being able to have those conversations. Now, I've sent texts for the last 3 years, just randomly. We haven't spoken for a long little text message. Guarantee that you're responding within 24 hours with something that I did not know. And that's just unbelievable. And I think that you get, you know, I've been watching and listening what you're doing and some of the guests that you've had on. They're blowing my mind. And it's so powerful still to hear those people on their journeys. And if I was able to hear that a little bit quicker, and been able to connect with it quicker than I did, it would have probably given me a lot more. I might have stopped and thought about the next step. I might not jump straight into IVF, but I think just being able to, you know, the response that I just gave around how do you like to receive support, they can reach out and have a chat with you. They can also just listen, and they can also see some of the blogs, things that you've done before. So I think just having that kind of connection would be vital. It's not all down to the NHS. They can signpost, and that information can be there, those first places that you walk into.
It's almost something that the NHS can't do. It's so busy. I mean, that's an amazing thing. And I totally agree with you there. Like that, that first step is the hardest.
Yeah.
It's getting momentum is the hardest. And if you've got support with those first few steps and guidance, the rest isn't going to be easy, but at least you'll have something to support you through it. Because we've all experienced how lonely it is.
100%.
So,
you mentioned leaflets in clinics. We're working on that. That's she's going to get two mentions in one episode. But Fran from Fertility Family, I sent her. How many was it, Kim? Was it 1,000?
Yeah,
she was a big, heavy box of leaflets that we got made, and she is diligently distributing them at the moment through the Southeast, all the clinics there that she visits, and
absolutely amazing.
Always making sure, she's such a good supporter of ours. She's always making sure that they are the first leaflets in the rack as well.
Absolutely amazing.
She sorts it all out, so at the front. Whenever Sean talks about the leaflets, all I get a flashback, right? Because Sean's like, he texts me, he said, the leaflets arrived. I was like, fantastic. He said, let's have a picture. And then he said, and then his little one had dropped them all over the floor. And he said, once she's finished picking them all up, they were everywhere.
You know, when someone like says, oh, what's your favorite car game? They go, 52 car pickup, and just spray them. it was 1,000 leaflet pickup. They were everywhere.
She was having a great time, but
amazing.
I don't think Sean was.
No, they will make an incredible difference. Honestly, I mean, I've had people that I know that have kind of gone listened to something that you've done and messaged me back, and then they've, you know, opened up to someone else on the back of it. Like, small little things still keep on happening, and it tends to be just, you know, they were keeping things closed off, and now all of a sudden, oh, there's somebody else that's been through it. So that is going to go a long way, I reckon. But yeah, I can't stress enough. Obviously, I came before you had a. I knew you before you both had a podcast, but what you've done is absolutely amazing. The people that you've had on, the guests that you've had on, but you two just chatting as well, like, bring so much. So huge, well done. Thank you very much for having me on.
Cheers, mate.
And it's our pleasure. Like, and honestly, I couldn't think of a better episode to end the series on. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, mate. And don't be a stranger.
Nice one. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.